Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Say Who Say Pod, episode 30, Danny, if you really can believe that.
We made it to 30?
That's a nice round number, isn't it?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I haven't checked. What's our subscribers at?
There's a few different ways to look at it. The RSS.com gives you like a followers number.
Uh-huh.
I think it's like a rough calculation of the average number of people who listen to each episode within 24 hours of publication.
Uh-huh.
And that's, there's several hundred there.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I won't get real specific with it. Other than, it's like it's an upper body injury. I'm not going to, I'm not going to say if it's an arm or a chest or whatever. But
yeah, dinged or bonked. I always loved those distinctions that were made. A ding was usually for with Holmgren, a ding was a muscle strain. A bonk would refer to a blow to the head. That someone got bonked meant that they were dealing with some concussion issues. We've gotten a little more precise with that.
I feel like dinged has become a little more universal than that.
Yeah.
Like a lot of coaches, that's kind of the catch-all for like, we're not going to have to amputate, but he's hurt.
My favorite, I think I've said this before, is when Pete Carroll will say, like when someone has to go on to injured reserve, he'll say, we've got to take care of them.
Yeah, it's a very grave situation.
I always think like, oh my God, don't put him down. Like he's still useful. He can still be do something. We're going to have to take care of him. Oh, no.
No. I think we recorded our last episode 8 days ago, and Washington's world has changed in a number of ways since then. Nearly all of them positive, with a little bit of consternation introduced last night. I'll run it down real quick here. So the Apple Cup week started with news of a 2-year contract extension for Kalen DeBoer.
Woohoo!
And a raise of about $1 million a year. It'll pay him $4.7 million by his final year, although, of course, college football, nobody ever comes to the final year of a contract. He'll either have a new contract or a new job by then. That's just how it goes with coaching. Washington then went out and won the Apple Cup 51-33 in Pullman to finish the regular season 10-2, the first 10-win season since 2018. They came home and began in earnest a Heisman Trophy campaign on social media for Michael Penix Jr. after he threw for 485 yards and is, I think, 108 yards away from breaking Cody Pickett's single-season school record. Turns out that before Kalen DeBoer agreed to terms on his contract extension, Ryan Grubb, the offensive coordinator, also signed a 2-year contract
Woo-hoo!
Extension. We'll keep him at Washington through 2025. Unless he takes another job, of course.
Any contract extensions for the defensive coaches?
None that we know of yet, no.
We'll see. I wonder why.
This felt like, aside from the long shot of long shot, Cal upset of UCLA or Colorado upset of Utah, this was the ideal weekend. Oregon lost to Oregon State.
Yeah, they did.
To fall behind Washington in the CFP rankings. That moved Utah into the championship game against USC, but there was seemingly nothing to worry about with the Utes. Washington was ranked 13th in the CFP rankings last week. Utah was ranked 14th. As long as they got Oregon out of the way, it seemed like Washington's path was going to be pretty clear to be the second highest ranked Pac-12 team, and therefore the obvious choice to replace USC in the Rose Bowl should USC take care of business in the Pac-12 championship and make the playoff. But the rankings came out last night, and Utah jumped 3 spots after its apparently extremely impressive victory over Colorado. And they are now ahead of Washington at 11th, with Washington at 12th. What do you think that means?
First of all, does it matter?
That's the big question.
Like that's like at the root of it, does it matter?
I kind of think it might.
Really? How?
So,
because I'm willing to get mad about this. I just want to parcel out, like, if this is one of those things, because when I looked at it, I was like, oh, does the football playoff committee want to make USC's potential victory look better so that to make sure that SC, if they win, gets into the Final Four, but it seems like they're pretty solidly in. Like there's nothing. So I was like, maybe they just want it to look like that it's the top 2 teams from the Pac-12 that are playing for the title and not have, hey, why isn't Washington in there?
I think those are very reasonable conclusions. And if I had to bet money on it, I would say it's more likely than not that this what that this doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Washington's Rose Bowl hopes hinge on the outcome of this game Friday. And if USC wins, they're likely going to be the replacement team. If Utah wins, obviously Utah goes and Washington is out of the New Year's Six. But I don't know why the committee would move Utah ahead of Washington after last week's results, if not to begin the case to justify leaving them ahead of Washington in the instance of, say, a really close loss. What if it's another game just like the one in Salt Lake City? It's a thriller. It comes down to the last play. This time USC comes out on top. How do you justify dropping Utah when they just played a really tough game against what's going to be a playoff team, a team that they'd already beaten, and they lost in very, you know, thrilling close fashion while Washington sat at home? Wouldn't Utah then have a case to stay ahead of them?
Well, sure, they've got a case, but they shouldn't win it because they have three losses.
I did enjoy Boot Corrigan, the CFP committee chair, answered a couple questions about this on his teleconference last night.
And I saw this. You transcribed them. This is where I started to get mad. And
I enjoy the pointing to the Arizona State loss as if they just learned about it.
I know. That loss looked really bad. And I was like, it should have looked just as bad a week ago.
Yeah, it was just brought to the attention of the committee that Washington lost to Arizona State on October 8th.
Because, Christian, honestly, I don't have a huge issue with Utah being in the Pac-12 championship game. Like, I'm not feeling that Washington got jobbed or hosed. It's a complicated tiebreaker. Utah's two losses are to better teams than Washington's two losses are. Now, Utah loses to an Oregon team that Washington beat, but they also drubbed Arizona State, which beats the UW. I'm not that fired up about, like, oh my gosh, it should be UW in that game. I wish it was UW in that game. Like, I really do. And there's part of me that feels if Washington, that it would feel differently to go to the Rose Bowl if they get there by beating USC, were to get there by beating USC, as opposed to if they go now, which will be essentially because Utah loses to USC and then Washington has decided to be. But if Utah loses, Utah has to fall behind Washington, right? Like, they have to.
You would think so.
I mean, they have to. They lost in non-conference. Like, we talked about this before, where kind of how I view what I think you have to look at the non-conference game not as sort of this, how good is that team actually, but what did it look like when you scheduled it? Did you schedule a layup that you lost? Did you schedule it was supposed to be a good team and that team was even... Like, I think Michigan State's, the victory, Washington's victory over Michigan State should be seen as a better result than it's being considered, because Michigan State was considered a good program and it was like that was when they scheduled it. But I mean, Utah's loss to Florida, like, I would say is in the same category. Florida's even a better program. Well, are they better now? No, they're probably not better now. But they lost. That Gators team isn't more impressive than Michigan State, is it? And they're a 500 team.
Yeah, I mean, it was in Gainesville in the first week. So that's tough. That's tough. That's a tough trip.
Sure, but I mean, look, Utah's ranked top 10 and people are talking about them being, they got three losses. If a four-loss team shouldn't go to the Rose Bowl. And I don't think it will.
Yeah, especially as a repeat team. Yeah. And especially, like, it's not off the table that the highest ranked Big Ten team is going to be Ohio State and the highest ranked Pac-12 team could well be Utah. And obviously, if they win, they're in no matter what. And you'd be talking about it like just a straight rematch. Potentially, if the committee did do the thing where they kept Utah ahead of Washington, even if they lost to USC, which, like, that's...
They can't do that, man.
That's what we were talking about last week with Oregon, right? Like, if Oregon beats Oregon State to get into the conference championship game at 10-2 and then loses to USC, what's the justification for dropping them behind Washington? The argument would be that Washington should already be ahead of them, right?
Yes.
So that's where I, just to deviate just a touch, like Dan Wetzel from Yahoo wrote, I thought, a really good column last week about how look, if you think Georgia, Michigan, TCU, and USC are the top four teams, which obviously they are, I don't think there's a lot of argument to that. All four of them won their respective divisions or are playing in their conference championship game. And his argument was, if you think those are the top four now, there should be nothing that can happen this weekend that changes that.
See, I don't
because they're all playing an extra game.
I don't agree with that, though. You play the game. You got to play the games that are set down in front of you. Like, I don't believe in the no risk game that, oh, you got to give them credit for being there. Like, no, that's not how college football works. A loss later in the season matters more than a loss earlier in the season. That's just the way it goes. And when people complain about it, I'm going to invoke the term that I used last week. Tough titty. Like, that's how it's always been. When Washington went to the Rose Bowl in 2000, they beat Miami early in the year. That's the Miami team that ended up winning the championship, right? And
that was the next year.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, because it was a big controversy that Miami didn't make the BCS national championship game. A lot of people thought they should have. Well, Washington also had one loss, and they had beaten Miami, and there was very little outcry about them being left out. I think it was Oklahoma against Was that the year it was like 11-2 or something? I know Oklahoma was in it.
I'm looking up. I'd always had it in my head that you had is, well, it's the 2001, right? 2001 BCS game because 2000, so it would have been the Orange Bowl.
Oklahoma beat Florida State 13-2. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was thinking it was Miami. Oh, it was the next year when Miami. Oh, that's right. Because there was the 9/11 game that was delayed.
Yeah. That was 9/11. That was the greatest, like maybe the best team in the history of college football. Miami team.
Pretty good team. There's some pretty good Nebraska mid 90s is the 95 or 94 team that a lot of people thought was the best ever.
Yeah. We'll say that Florida State team that played the national championship, they did lose at Miami that year. That was their one loss. So Florida State had one loss and lost to Miami. Miami had one loss and lost to Washington. Washington had one loss and lost to Oregon. Oregon State had one loss and lost to Washington. So
that was of all the different teams. Like that was the one because the Beavs were lining up for what was a pretty makeable field goal. And then I think they took a delay a game. And then I think the field goal was missed. There were late game hijinks that happened there that ended up making the field goal attempt longer than it was going to be, and then they missed it. And I remember Dennis Erickson getting asked if it was a moral victory afterward, which was awesome. That was extremely funny. Yeah. If I can see, I don't agree with it, but I can see the argument for two teams with the same record, and even though one team has a head-to-head victory over the other team, I can see and understand the argument to sort of throw out that as the natural tiebreaker, even though I don't agree with it. Like, right? Like, I will always believe that head-to-head, and if you're choosing between two teams and one of them is beating the other head-to-head, even if it's on the winning team's home field, that you should, that's how things are decided. That should be the tiebreaker. But I can see. But if you got more losses and a head-to-head victory, like you can't, like I can't wrap my head around how you could sell that, especially in a year like there's been some years where Washington has crummy non-conference schedules, like this year wasn't one of those. Like Michigan State, Kent State, and then the cupcake, like that's not a terrible non-conference schedule. I might even say it's like a B non-conference schedule.
So in 2016, which is the precedent year for the Rose Bowl replacement team not having played in the Pac-12 championship game, Washington went to the playoff. They beat Colorado, I think, 41-9 in the conference championship game, and the Rose Bowl wound up taking USC. Colorado entered championship week ranked 8th, and USC entered championship week ranked 11th. So they were separated by 3 spots, and Colorado's loss to Washington was convincing enough that they fell from 8th to 10th. In the final rankings, and USC jumped from 11th to 9th, one spot ahead of them, and the Rose Bowl took USC. That was a little bit different, though, because USC had beaten both conference championship game participants head to head, including winning at Washington in week 10. So I think that, you know, if you're Colorado, yeah, you won your division. You had to play an extra game. USC didn't, against a playoff team. But, like, you know, everyone kind of knew who the best team, you know, the best available team at that time was. I don't know that the circumstances are the same this year, but I do, like, ultimately, I do land kind of where you are with, I just don't see the Rose Bowl taking a four-loss team when there's a 10-2 team that's won six straight, that's got this exciting offense and all that just sitting right there. But it is odd that the committee would make this move this week. Like, I think it's, even though Utah's 9-3 and Washington's 10-2, you can make a perfectly logical argument that Utah should be ranked ahead of them. There's very little logical argument to be made that they should have moved ahead of Washington based on last week's results.
Yeah, there's none. And that's, but that gets back to the entire lunacy of how we decide college football things, right? Like, the process gets jury-rigged to get the desired result. And they pretend that it's some sort of big calculator. So you have actually insane things happen. Like, the guy that you transcribed the teleconference from just finding out that Washington lost to Arizona State, right? Like, they have to pretend that it makes sense. And I don't think we're obligated to go along with their little ruse. Like, I think we can just say they make it up as they go along. Is the Rose Bowl going to choose Utah or Washington? A four-loss Utah team or a two-loss Washington? It's going to choose Washington, right? Like, I just don't have any doubt about that. I think there are some questions. Do we just assume Ohio State is coming to the Rose Bowl? Like, is that just because they're not going to play again, right? Like, is that where they're going to end up?
Well, Penn State is only three spots behind right now.
Right.
So
Ohio State was there last year and has been there a couple times. Like, Ohio State was in there in 2017, the 2018 game, correct?
Well, they were there for the 2018 season, the 2019 game against Washington.
I get that so mixed up. That's right. That is 2018.
It's a consolation game for them.
Yes.
So I think that's a consideration. Now, would they take a Big Ten team three spots behind them? Nah, I don't know.
They might, man. How did Ohio State travel last year?
I don't think super well. I don't know, though. The thing with Rose Bowl travel that always, like, it always sells out, right?
Yes.
So, I don't know, like, how do you determine whether someone traveled well if like, the stadium's always at capacity?
You can kind of tell. You can kind of tell when there's a school that's happy to be there and when there's not. Like, there's a different energy when a school that hasn't been there in a while. And maybe I'm biased in that regard because I remember so clearly the 2000 season, the 2001 Rose Bowl, when Purdue was there. Like, Purdue hadn't been there forever. It was Drew Brees. And the Purdue fans were so happy to be there. Like, there is a real energy. So I do think that even if it's not ticket sales, the actual energy surrounding the game and all of the different stuff that's there, I think that does matter. And I think it mattered, but that might be my overly romanticized idea of the game.
Yeah, I think they care about those things for sure. And I don't know if they're looking at what the better, like, TV matchup is or anything, or TV markets. It just seems like we're wired to consider that in all aspects of college football now. How many people are going to watch? What's the rating going to be?
Does the Rose Bowl care about that?
I don't know. I think they want, like you said, they want two teams and two fan bases that really, really want to be there. And they, you know, they want the stadium to look awesome with the sun setting over the sand. I totally forgot the game's on January 2nd, by the way.
Yeah, they bumped him back a day. That happens every once in a while. I can't blame this on the idiot power structure in college football.
I'm gonna. So I don't know. The rankings last night introduced a little twist, but yeah, I still think. And by the way, like, the Rose Bowl doesn't have to take the next highest ranked team. They traditionally do, and I think they very much try to stick to that. But, like, ultimately, it is their choice. And especially if you're talking about teams being separated by literally one spot, I would think they would just take whoever made the most sense. But with that said, Yeah, like if USC wins, you know, the only way that you're even sweating probably whether Washington is going to stay behind Utah or jump ahead of them is if it's a really close game and it's a really tight, you know, last second type loss. You know, the best thing for Washington would be USC goes out and wins by two or more scores, and then I think they can feel pretty confident that that Utah would drop behind them in the final rankings.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking about last night, because I'm a total idiot? I was imagining, I was like, what would this look like in early 90s pre-BCS bowl configuration? Because, I mean, I have a longstanding, I don't necessarily think that the BCS and the college football playoff have been an improvement. I think it's different. I think it can have some upsides. I think there's some detriment. Like, I don't think it's this slam dunk, like, oh, there's a better mousetrap now than before. Because if there isn't, if we're in the old bowl configuration, like with conference tie-ins and that sort of thing, you would have the Rose Bowl would be USC versus Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have your Big 12 champion, TCU, presuming they win, goes to the Orange Bowl, would face an independent. You've got the SEC team that's going to the Sugar Bowl.
Against the ACC team?
Maybe. And I think there was always, you could choose ACC or you could go. I bet that would probably be Ohio State.
Yeah.
I think that's who they'd choose. And then maybe you'd have Alabama versus TCU. It might come out like it was supposed to. And basically it would be like, if Michigan wins, if Michigan beats USC, they're the national champion. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. Georgia. I'm all screwed up there. You'd have probably Georgia against Ohio State. I guess you would still have the possibility of Michigan and Georgia not playing, and that would be unsatisfying. But I was looking at it, I was like, is what we end up with going to be better than what you would have had with kind of four meaningful games?
Nothing's going to be as good as when there's a 12-team playoff and Tulane will be involved, because they'd be in it. They'd be in it this year. They'd be the sixth highest ranked conference champion.
That'd be funny. Really be funny.
That's going to happen every year. There's going to be at least one of those every year, which I think is fun.
Yeah, I don't mind that part. I don't mind that part. The part that I'll mind is people who would be arguing that the fourth best SEC team should be in there in front of Tulane, because that will happen. Like, they will, and you will hear, and they'll be right that it is a better team than Tulane. But I'm like, no, you're the fourth best team in your conference. Get out of here with that. Like, the power, like, you got to win something to get in.
And they'll get four teams in anyway.
Probably. How about the noise about, like, oh, Alabama should be in there? It's like, they lost twice. Like, shut your pie hole. Like, no, you don't get in with two losses. You lost twice.
I would still, and call it West Coast bias, whatever. I would have a hard time dropping USC. Again, if you think USC is currently the fourth best team, I would have a hard time dropping them below either Ohio State or Alabama with a close loss to Utah in the championship game when neither Ohio State or Alabama had to play this week.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that. And the other thing is, why would you want to do that? Like, why would you... Other than you think SEC football is the best and they deserve to be there, or like you love Ohio State and you're one of those the sort of the mindless, like, you had an opportunity, it was all laid out. Alabama lost twice, and Ohio State couldn't beat its rival. They got the break speed off of them. Man, that was satisfying. Did you see Burt Breer, who's a NFL reporter, who's like this big Ohio State honk? And then he had a tweet after, because he had all this like, make it miserable for anybody wearing the Michigan colors. And then after they lost, he goes, the worst thing about it here is it's just a bunch of dorks celebrating. Like, the nerds, every nerd at your high school is having his day. So somebody was like, your name is Albert. Your name is Albert. He is who I think of when I think of the most annoying Ohio State fans. Like, they do have a pretty specifically annoying fan base.
I don't know that I have a poster child for that fan base necessarily.
Do you like them?
It is kind of funny, though.
Am I kind of, or maybe it's just that they're good now, so they inevitably end up becoming good.
I feel like that's the case with, like, yeah, every program that has sustained success probably ends up rubbing everyone else the wrong way.
Alabama fans aren't bad, though. SEC fans, like, I they're annoying under the umbrella, but they're not more annoying than other SEC fans.
I've thought this before, like, is it still fun to be an Alabama fan?
Great question.
When you, the expectation is that you win every game by multiple scores, can't you only ever be disappointed?
Yeah.
I don't know. I know Nick Saban, you know, Nick Saban's as grumpy or whatever as it gets, and he always seems to, you know, really revel in winning championships. And I know he said before, like, you know, no one is the same. It's a different team every year. It's a different group of guys, a different, you know, different challenges overcome and all that. So maybe the fan base reflects that. But, like, I know just even being there in 2016 when they played Washington in the playoff, and the questions that the you know, their players were getting asked all week about, you know, is this your best team ever? Is this, you know, do you think you're a dynasty? And guys talking about how, you know, in past teams that won the SEC and lost in the playoff, they consider that a lost year and a failure. And I'm just like, man, if the fan base buys into this, which I'm sure they do, because they're, you know, they're seeing what's in front of them, like, how do you ever enjoy yourself? But I guess winning national championships is fun.
You know what it is? It's that when the school becomes successful like that and becomes, I guess the word is, and I hate this word for teams, the national brand, is that I don't think it's the true fans whose experience, like the people that cheered for and rooted through some of the different, because there's been times when Alabama football's been down. And they still have a pretty passionate following. Like, it's not their experiences that are skewed by it. It's the front runner fans, right? Like, it's the people, and probably the same is true with Ohio State, that the Ohio State fan that was there through the John Cooper era understands kind of what, that these things go in ebbs and flows, and there will be a time when Ohio State, sort of the tide recedes. And maybe they'll think, hey, we've turned a corner and all of this. But there's not that same sort of like, oh my God, this is an awful year when we didn't win the national championship. And maybe that's how the experience goes. I love college football. Like, it's my favorite sport to watch, despite my serious misgivings about the fact that the players are not paid and that it's governed by morons. But, like, when Washington has been really good, it's not like I came with, like, this year. Like, it's a 10-2 year. It's been an awesome and incredibly fun year, no matter what happens at the end of it. Like, I've enjoyed it. And I don't have this sort of like, oh man, if they just hadn't lost Arizona State, because I'm also, well, they also beat Oregon State in a game that they didn't really think they were going to win. Like, you enjoy the overall experience. And that's probably the difference between, like, an actual diehard fan and somebody who likes winning and is drawn to the program because of their success.
It is wild to think if they'd beaten Arizona State, they'd be probably playing for a playoff spot this week.
That's crazy.
But like you said, like, I think water finds its level. You know, this was not a playoff team.
Yeah.
This was not a team built to succeed in the playoffs against a Georgia or Michigan type of team. It would be very interesting to watch Washington's offense match up against, you know, a really elite defense and just see, okay, you know, can they move it? Can they score points? Can Michael Penix Jr. still find those receivers and scheme guys open and stuff? But
they wouldn't force a punt against good teams.
Defensively.
Oh, just brutal. Like that 2016 team. So this is when going into the Pac-12 championship game in 2016, like, I had a very strong feeling that, like, I want UW to win the conference and go to the Rose Bowl. Like, I don't really care if they get picked for the playoff. Like, it's been at that point 16 years since they've been to the Rose Bowl. Like, I want to go to the Rose Bowl. And that changed. Like, that changed kind of leading that day of the game against Colorado and sort of leading through it. Like, I did. I was like, oh, I'll be disappointed. And they went to the Peach Bowl and I went to the game, and they belonged in that game, right? Like, they, it's not like they almost won it or that they were, but that was a team, like, they had a really good defense, and that was a really good Alabama team, and they scored early, and kind of the offense that had kind of hit its high point early in the year had its trouble, but Washington belonged in that game. I don't think I'd feel the same way about this Washington team if they were going into the playoff.
It's funny, because I was thinking about that game – in the context of like, what would, you know, what would Michael Penix and this offense have looked like matched with Washington's 2016 defense?
Oh,
like,
that's interesting.
If you took this offense and put it in that game. But then it's also like, that's a funny hypothetical to consider when statistically the 2016 offense was one of their greatest ever. Like, yeah. Their quarterback threw 43 touchdown passes.
He did.
They had the first team all-conference tailback, who also, by the way, wound up being the career leader at the school in rushing yards and touchdowns. Like, they had John Ross.
Yeah.
They had Dante Pettis. Like, that was one of the highest performing offenses they've literally ever had. They blew out nearly everybody they played, and yet you still would, you know, between Washington's offense and Washington's defense that year, you would still circle them as probably the lesser unit, which is kind of wild.
Coming out of the Alabama game, my feeling was, okay, that's a team that if you're going to beat them, you need your quarterback to be able to beat them. And mm-hmm. and Browning was a true sophomore at that point, and that's an awful lot to ask because there were a lot of NFL dudes on that Alabama defense. But you were going to need somebody that it really, like, they were able to deal with the amount of pressure and find the open guy, whether it was through processing speed or being able to create time, that your quarterback needed to be the X factor. And I think some of this is Penix's experience. I really think we've seen him do that throughout this season. He didn't start out great against the Cougs, but by halftime, you knew he was rolling, and you're like, this is done. At least that's how I felt at halftime, even though it was, was it a 1-point game?
Like, it was, yeah.
The Cougs kicked the field goal before. I was so confident that Washington was going to win that game because I was like, Penix has got it going, man, and you're not going to touch him. Like, he's been an incredible quarterback to watch.
It did feel like, and I think Kalen DeBoer kind of alluded to this too a couple times, it did feel like Washington was scoring very efficiently and very easily, you know, kind of however it wanted. And Washington State, I mean, give Cam Ward a ton of credit. That guy takes a lot of criticism from Wazoo fans, and
really?
I kind of get it. He misses some throws. He hasn't been the real, like, pinpoint, you know, just kill you down the field quarterback that I think they kind of pumped him up as. He doesn't get any protection, which doesn't help.
Yeah.
But man, I thought for a guy playing behind such an inexperienced offensive line, He was doing everything he could to extend plays and make stuff happen. He throws a touchdown pass on 4th and 10, and they wound up sacking him 6 times.
Yeah.
He was pressured on 37 of his 68 dropbacks.
He was running for his life.
Yeah. So, and, you know, maybe he takes off early sometimes, and that's always a balance too. I thought he looked like a guy who could really excel in that offense if they can get some O-linemen in front of him.
There's nobody that thinks that he shouldn't be the quarterback going forward, do they?
No. Nothing like
I mean,
that.
he looks really good. And that is coming from someone who was very suspicious because he came from Incarnate Word.
That's right.
I think, seriously, like, when he transferred, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And watching him this year, I was like, no, man, he's incredible because he doesn't have protection. And his ability to move around and still make plays and throw down the field, I think he's awesome.
There was, like, I think there was a touchdown they could have had where he missed a guy. And then the amazing diving catch by Robert Farrell that where the ball actually hit the ground and it got overturned. You know, he had him open there, and if he, you know, he did, it was an amazing catch, or almost catch, an amazing play on the ball because it was overthrown, right? So there's a couple times he missed his spot where they, you know, maybe the game could have been different. But, you know, then you're talking about the opposing quarterback needs to be perfect to keep you in the game. But, you know, that was kind of the vibe, I think, from Washington, was that they were scoring so easily and Wazoo was keeping up, but it was like taking everything they had to keep up. It was taking a bunch of fourth down conversions, and they, you know, great call, great execution with the fake punt. It did feel like a game that eventually the dam was going to break and Washington was going to pull away, and that's what happened. I'm wondering from you, you know, you've been watching Husky football a while. You've seen some really good teams, and, you know, you've been to Rose Bowls and all these sort of things. Where does this season rank for you as a fan on, like, the satisfaction scale? Just coming off of last year, winning the way that they've won, scoring points the way that they have, winning at Oregon, winning the Apple Cup. I mean, where will this season go down for you as you take kind of the in the moment view of it here?
So my favorite season was the 2000 season with Tuiasa Sopo, right? Like, that was just an incredible year. And they went through, I mean, with the Curtis Williams injury factored mm-hmm. in there, and the way they closed out games was really, really remarkable. That was probably my favorite year, the year that I enjoyed the most. Where does this one rank compared to like 2016, 2018? They beat Oregon. God, this might be this might be my second favorite of the past 20 years. No, that 2016 year and going to the Peach Bowl and like being in the playoff and having that comeback. It's probably number three behind that year. Cause that you had the end of the Oregon streak as well. And Jake Browning pointing and they hung 70 on him in Hudson. Yeah. So it's number three. It goes 2000, 2016. And then this season, has been more fun than the 2018 Rose Bowl year. And that was a year I really liked. I loved cheering for Ben Burke-Irvin. Like, that was a really, I really liked the players on that defense. Like, I enjoyed that an awful lot. But there was 2018, it's kind of tough because I think Jake, Washington has a hard, there's a difficult thing where Washington fans end up feeling kind of negative about some of their best quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. Right, like the Heward brothers and Jake Browning, I would put very much in the same category. Everybody likes Cody Pickett, and everybody loves Tuiasa Sopo, but like both Damon and Brock, and I'll throw Jake Browning in there, were really successful quarterbacks. Like, they were really good players, and by the end, with each one of those quarterbacks, there was a level of hostility, or I don't want to say with, well, there was hostility at times though. Like, there was hostility at times toward Damon and definitely toward Brock because his last season was so bad. And with Jake, even though they were successful that last season, losing that game to Auburn where he didn't play particularly well and sort of this feeling of he's regressed and all of those conversations, I feel that's too bad. Like, I think that, not to get on a soapbox, but I feel like Washington.
Get on the soapbox.
I feel like Washington fans, like those quarterbacks deserve to be remembered better than they are. And definitely in the moment, like at the time that those guys were done, there wasn't the acknowledgement of the accomplishments that they had. And the difference this year is that everybody's just been, like, Penix has been so much fun. But it's felt a little different because he came here, right? Like, there's a little bit of Corey Dillon feeling to it. I hope he stays, but I also don't have that much investment on whether he stays or not. I've loved watching him play. I think it's a joke that Caleb Williams is being sort of touted as a Heisman candidate and not Penix, but I think that that's just chalked up to the dynamics of this stupid sport or the stupid people that govern the sport. It's been really fun to watch him. So I guess that's a long and roundabout way of saying that, like, it's been incredibly fun. It's been a blast to watch him quarterback the team this year. But it's also made me feel that kind of sometimes we don't appreciate sort of the career longevity that some of the other quarterbacks have had at the school.
Yeah, that's a really good point. By the way, David Shaw resigned.
did he get forced out?
That's another news item. It sure doesn't seem like it.
I know.
It seems like
he was kind of the last to know. He's like, yeah, I guess I really am not committed anymore. he looked at the ashes of the past two seasons and he said, for who, for what?
It feels like a Chris Peterson situation where there was a whole lot more losing involved.
Yeah.
Like, I think he looked at probably the same forces that Chris Peterson was looking at, like transfer portal, NIL.
But it seems like Stanford's the one place that would be immune to that. Because, like, you can get Stanford is a particular type of player that is geared up for it. Like, I'm convinced that was Tyrone Willingham's biggest problem, was that, like, the players you recruit to Washington are a different kind of self-starter than the guys or than the guys he was used to and thrived with at Stanford. Like there was a little more heavy lifting that he needed to be willing and able to do at Washington that he was not, because he was like, this is not how Stanford gets. I was like, yeah, well, the kids you're coaching couldn't get into Stanford, like Tyrone, like that. I couldn't get into Stanford. Like you got to adjust your means. That'd be weird. I can't.
So
would Peterson fit there?
I think he'd be a perfect institutional fit. I have a hard time seeing him wanting to get back into it. Here's the thing. Like, if you don't want to deal with NIL and the new college football landscape, yes, it's true that there probably won't be the same pressures at Stanford.
Yeah.
But it's by virtue of it's going to make it way harder to win.
Like, yeah, that's true. That's true.
You're essentially taking a job with one hand tied behind your back. And then, like, with the transfer portal, too. Yes, it's true what you said. There are always going to be a handful of kids in every class who are really good prospects, who could mostly go to any school, who are going to choose Stanford because they want to go to Stanford.
Yeah.
Because it's Stanford. It's they like do Richard have that
Sherman.
Pull.
Richard Sherman could have gone to USC, could have gone to a number of places. Like, exactly. He went to Stanford because he wanted to go to Stanford.
But they have lost several very good players through the transfer portal the last couple of years, and they don't have the ability to replace them.
Oh, that's true, too.
They brought in, I forget who it was. There was one kid they got this year, graduate student, who literally applied to Stanford on his own, got in, got accepted to a grad program at Stanford, and then called David Shaw or whoever at Stanford and said, hey, I got accepted. Can I transfer? And if you do that, then you can. But they won't save spots for you. It's really hard to do. It doesn't happen on the front end. You don't say, hey, we're taking this kid as a transfer and let's get him into school. Yeah. You got to reverse engineer it. And I don't think a whole lot of guys are going to want to go through that process. So, like, it's going to be like, I don't, unless the university, you know, bends to the athletic department's wishes, or if they even want to do that, I don't know. But no. I feel like that's one of many things that David Shaw probably looked around and was like, we aren't any good. We're 3-9 again. This program is not what it was, and it's now infinitely harder for me to turn this thing around year to year than it would have been 5 years ago. I'm out. I don't want to deal with this. So it was Peterson-esque in that way, but with a whole lot more losing before it happened.
It's funny the ebbs and flows that Stanford goes through, and they've been on a relative high for so long that you forget like the ups and downs. Because they've had great coaches there. Like, not just Bill Walsh, but Denny Green came from there. Tyrone was an incredibly successful coach there. Jim Harbaugh, and then David Shaw. But they have also had some stinkers. Like, they have been terrible. Like, Walt Harris, Buddy Tevens. Like, that is a program that they might have the most volatility of any program in the conference. In terms of, there have been times when they've been very good and competitive, and then times when they've just been awful. Like, Oregon State has been more on the just awful side than being really good. Arizona has been fairly mid, I would say, mid to bad. Like, Stanford's been great, and Stanford's been god-awful terrible as well. I guess Washington has, too, because they were 0-12 in addition to going to the Rose Bowl in 2000. Like, when you go 0-12 and win the conference championship in the span of time that Washington did, was it like 8 years? That probably qualifies as extreme variance as well.
One of those... perhaps the very worst Stanford team of that run won its only game at Husky Stadium.
Sure did. That's when we knew 0-12 was in play.
For what it's worth, Bruce Feldman at The Athletic wrote his always writes a story when there's a coaching change about who the leading candidates are. He knows Chris Peterson well.
Yes, he does.
From throughout his career, but obviously they're colleagues now at Fox Sports, and he wrote. The big wild card for this job is Peterson. He got Washington into the CFP and had 4 top 10 seasons in 8 years with the Broncos. No football coach is more thoughtful or better at creating a winning culture, but Peterson is very self-aware in a way many winning football coaches just aren't, or at least not to that degree. He eventually realized it was best for him to leave the sidelines. I don't think he would want to come back to coaching for almost any job or situation. Stanford is a unique deal, and maybe it would be the rare opportunity that would intrigue the Northern California native. But intriguing him and getting him to jump back into big-time college football and the craziness of it with the portal and an NIL and 365-day-a-year recruiting probably would be tough for him to buy into. So that's not somebody just throwing out, hey, here's what I think based on what I know of Chris Peterson. That's somebody who knows him personally. Who knows if there's any actual Chris Peterson insight tied into that, but that's certainly as good of insight into probably where Chris Peterson's at as you're going to get. So if Bruce is willing to put on the record that he thinks it's a long shot, then it's probably really a long shot.
Who do we think is going to get the Colorado job? Because it's Kenny Dillingham is in Arizona State. I know that Tyler Palumbus, who was a former Seahawk and played in the NFL for a while, he's a Buff. He went to CU. And he said earlier this week that he thought it was more likely than not that Deion would end up there, which I was like, wow, that would be... Can you imagine Deion Sanders in the Pac-12?
He confirmed he was offered the job.
Is he not going to take it?
I don't know. That's what I saw the report that he said that the report was true. He'd been offered, and I was like, there's... there's one more question I'd like to ask. You going to take it?
Oh, how about Hugh Freeze, man?
I think of the Batman movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger is Mr. Freeze.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Conan O'Brien did a really like funny riff on that a couple years ago. He's like, I'm Mr. Freeze. So whenever I see Hugh Freeze's name, it's just the first thing I think of.
Do you know what?
Has nothing to do with anything, and I'm an idiot. But
do you know what I think of? I think of the hospital. Something else. No. Like, well, I mean, so I feel like we'll kind of say there's stuff you can laugh at with Hugh Freeze, and there's stuff you can't laugh at. I would say that the using the school cell phone, the school provided cell phone to contact a sex worker. And initially explaining that it was a misdial until they showed that it was 12 misdials to this number, at which point he resigned because he was going to get fired because you can't. I mean, I think it broke a state law. Like, I think you can't use a school provided device for that, or violated the morals clause or whatever the hell it was. Like, I feel that's like firmly in the mid of being able. The stuff that's not funny and like really concerning is like 6 months ago he's been the head coach at Liberty football. He was sending private direct messages to a woman who was, I mean, she was a rape victim who was suing Liberty, and she'd been critical of the fact that Liberty, the school she's suing, had hired the former athletic director from Baylor, where like the issue there was failing to adequately investigate and protect students and alert students and punish guys who were accused of sexual assault. And he's sending unsolicited direct messages to her. But the first thing that I think of, so this is outside of all of those behavior things, is a hospital bed.
Oh, right.
Do you remember
that's
that?
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right.
He had them haul a hospital bed into the stadium so he could coach. He had a potentially, like, he had a serious staph infection, and he's there in a hospital bed coaching. Like,
the boys needed to see him. the boys needed to see their coach toughen it out. You know, that just reminded me. As much as we've talked about Paul Petrino or Bobby Petrino,
yeah,
on this podcast. Did you see our David Ubbin, The Athletic, wrote a retrospective of the Bobby Petrino motorcycle incident?
No. Oh, I've got
it. It was really good. It's really good. He insisted on doing that press conference against the advice of administrators at Arkansas because he wanted to show his team that he was being tough like he asked them to be. There's a lot of details about the. He talked to the reporter who broke the story and yeah, details about, like, I think the
God,
he I don't know if he's a sheriff's deputy or yeah. Local law enforcement who was part of Paul Petrino's like game day security, you know, detail.
Yes.
Had like come and picked him up, and they took Correct. Him to some like off the beaten path hospital instead of the major hospitals, and
they tried to get him to not. I think one of the issues was they tried to have like preempt a police report.
Well, he didn't. Yeah, they tried to do everything they could to not have the woman's presence listed on the police
report. Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't the actual police report. It was the fact that they didn't want it mentioned that he had somebody else riding on the back of his motorcycle.
Yeah, and a TV reporter got the police report. I think it had been tipped off. Hey, this isn't what it appears to be. And like he tracked him down after his press conference. He was like riding away on a golf cart, and he approached him, you know, in a one-on-one ish setting, and was like, "Hey, one more thing. Were you alone on that motorcycle?" And he said no. And he asked him one more time, "Are you sure?" And he said no again. And I'm sure in that moment he had to have known, like, oh no, this guy knows. Mm-hmm. This guy knows, and I'm toast.
That's too
But
funny.
You should read this. I'd recommend everybody to read the story. It's a fascinating look back at that whole saga.
I've said that college football is my favorite sport. One of the reasons that it's my favorite is because of the insane things that surround coaching and coaching searches.
Yes.
Like and Hugh Freeze is right in the middle of that, from sending text messages to a phone that he thought was Archie Manning's, wanting to get the Ole Miss job and having that be an old phone number for Archie Manning. So somebody came out and said, "Who the hell is Hugh Freeze?" And at that point, the Ole Miss coach, Houston Nutt, knew that someone was angling for the job that he'd had, to how mad Nutt was after Hugh Freeze tried to lay all of these recruiting infractions on his doorstep and say that they were due to the whole thing. It's just pure SEC, and now he's at Auburn, which is hilarious. How long do you think Hugh lasts?
Well, how many games does he win? Does he beat? See, this is why the Lane Kiffin talk made no sense to me. You're already in the SEC. Why would you leave for a job where your success is based on how often you beat Nick Saban?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
So how often is Hugh Freeze going to beat Nick Saban? Now, he's done it before, right? That's kind of his thing. Like he's been very successful against successful head coaches.
I think he's going to get canned in year five. And I think it'll be a glorious like implosion in year five. I think he'll beat Alabama in one of his first three seasons, and that will inspire like all of this talk of like he's finally got it turned around. Year four is going to be disappointing, and they're going to bite the bullet and go one more year with him. And then year five, it's going to be a colossal explosion.
Yeah, well, year five. I mean, you got to measure Auburn 10 years in dog years, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Because that's like a 35-year tenure if he makes it to year five.
Will
he beat Alabama?
Yeah, he'll beat Alabama. I think he's going to beat Alabama one of his first 3 years.
I kind of feel like he's going to get some dudes in there, and they're going to have like at least a couple of like 10-win type of seasons.
Yeah, maybe. I just...
Dude, bad coaches have done really well at Auburn.
Yeah.
Like at least for a year at a time.
And then they all leave in weirds. Like it is... Bomani Jones made this point. They either leave just beaten down or mired in scandal. Like going back a long way, like Pat Dye, when he was on the way out, it was NCAA sanctions. Terry Bowden was there and was really successful, and then he left and was never the same. And there's never been a real clear answer of why he got the boot, but clearly something really untoward happened. You had Tommy Tuberville there. Gus Malzahn. Who's the Gene Chizik, who I think they hired from Iowa State, and he had just a god-awful record, but he'd been the defensive coordinator at Auburn.
Won a national title.
Mired in scandal, right? Like, in retrospect, everybody looks back, and Cam Newton and all of the different, like, it's a, and now you're going to be in the NIL, which I don't know if it helps or hurts. Like, do you think that helps? Does the NIL help or hurt a dirty coach?
Man.
Because
I think it helps, because the general conclusion is that lawyers would challenge any NCAA action against NIL, right?
Yes, but it hurts in that you're not the only guy doing it, and your lack of morals previously gave you an advantage, and now you don't really have that. Right? Like, if you were willing to be Jerry Tarkanian like in the kind of program you run, like, and you're like, okay, you're gonna constantly be at war with the NCAA, and you're probably eventually, they're gonna get you one way or another. Like, there were a certain number of guys who weren't willing to do that. Like, now that that specter's off the table. Like, everybody can go fire money at people.
This is we're coming into like the first like potentially litigious transfer portal cycle where you're going to have a lot of guys who probably signed some stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that they're going to leave and they're going to be like, no, you can't leave because you signed this.
Well, not you can't leave, but we're not going to fulfill the terms of the contract because you left, or, you know, they'll be unhappy with what they're getting, and that's why they'll leave, and they'll look for something more. And because I think the Athletic's reporting around these like big collective deals for, you know, five-star recruits or whatever, all said that in order to comply with the, you know, oh, you can't use it as an inducement rule, that none of those deals actually like required enrollment at a particular school or whatever.
Yeah.
I think, you know, depending on how many of those type of deals are actually in existence, like if they're really commonplace, if it's just there's a couple here and there, we may be coming up on the era here in the next cycle or two where you're going to see those challenged, and we're going to find out just exactly, you know, how binding those are. Will there be guys who signed NIL deals who will still try to fulfill the terms of them, you know, while also leaving for to play for another school?
No, like we all know, I know it's not in the contract, but the only reason you're getting that was there. Maybe I will live to regret these words. I'm kind of looking forward to it. Like, I'm kind of looking forward to the massive sort of chaos that's going to ensue. And the reason for that is because I believe that the NCAA's, and at this point it's beyond the NCAA, like, I mean, really just college sports attempt to create a workaround to actually paying the players. They're trying to pay the players without paying the players, right? Like, that's what NIL essentially is. And it's going to create chaos. It's going to create bidding wars, which we saw a little bit last year. And it's going to create exactly what you just said of like terms of a deal that change when that player goes somewhere else, because those deals couldn't be tied to the attendance of a specific school that are going to. I look forward to the chaos.
Was a nice final week of the regular season for us to end on with our picks. We each went 5-2. I went 10-2-1 the last 2 weeks.
Heck yeah.
How about that?
On fire.
Pull above 500 with a regular season record of 34-29-1. You were 32-31-1. So look, if you bet with our picks, you made money this year, folks.
Nah, not with me, with you. You'd lose it with me on the VIG. You'd lose it on the VIG.
Yeah, yeah. And with mine would eat into it a little ways,
the
too.
The juice.
If but you I, bet I think 10 grand per game,
yeah,
you might have done some damage.
If you bet 10 grand per game on our picks, you're an idiot. Like, really, really dumb.
It's also like, we, you know, by picking every game, you're not you know, that's like a forced sample size, right? It's not like we're sitting down and saying, okay, what are the most advantageous lines, what are the games we feel best about? It's just we're gonna pick every Pac-12 game, which you wouldn't do if you were actually gambling with any sort of strategy. One more this week. USC is a 3-point favorite. What do you think happens in Vegas on Friday night?
Give me the Trojans. Betting with my heart. Give me the Trojans. Give me the Trojans, because I want them to win big and take any question out of where Washington ends up.
I agree. I think not for caring about the outcome, but I agree USC is going to cover the 3. Doesn't it feel like the Trojans have gotten a lot better since they lost to Utah, and Utah kind of hasn't?
Yes.
And I think Cam Rising's health is a big piece of that. He missed the Wazoo game. He hasn't really been running as much, right? Which is a huge weapon for them. So we'll kind of see. You know, clearly he's been playing through something. We'll see how unleashed he is in this game. But I do think USC gets this one done. Just kind of feels like they got it rolling. Caleb Williams is really in a groove. You don't think he should be the Heisman front runner?
Why should he get it over Penix?
He's thrown for more touchdowns. He's got 10 rushing touchdowns. Team's only got one loss.
I don't have a complaint about Caleb Williams winning it. Like, I generally root for West Coast players. But I think Penix has had the better season. Like, and I don't think it's that close. Caleb Williams has had a much better defense. They haven't relied nearly as much on him, and he came to a much better situation. Like, Penix came to a dumpster fire. Like, that's in the turnaround that he's had. I think it'd be funny if Caleb Williams wins the Heisman and Penix ends up sort of getting offensive player of the year in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I was talking about that possibility the other day. Like, someone had suggested, well, maybe maybe the coaches would in order to honor both guys, they'd vote one offensive player of the year and vote the other as the first team quarterback.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah.
I do think I will see. We'll see how petty the coaches want to be about the whole USC going to the Big Ten thing.
And, you know, I thought it was going to be how petty the coaches want to be on how many damn transfers USC got.
Well, I mean, everybody's got to do that, right? Like, who's not taking transfers?
SC was extra level, though. Didn't they have something like 19 in their two deeps? They had a lot.
Yeah. So what's your perspective on that? Like, I feel like that is that's on the pros list of why Lincoln Riley is the Pac-12 coach of the year.
Yeah.
Like, being able to go out and do that. Now, USC is advantaged over everybody.
Do you think that Lincoln Riley did a better coaching job than DeBoer?
It's hard. See, they both took over 4-8 teams that I think DeBoer took over a team, and they did go get Penix, and that was huge. And obviously they've got some other transfers starting on defense.
USC's a better team, right? Like, they're a more complete team. I think their offense isn't quite as good as Washington's. Like, they've got a better all around team, better record. It's a better team. Just watching them, USC's a better team. But DeBoer, man, like, he inherited a much worse situation at a program that didn't have that kind of status. And when Lincoln Riley went from Oklahoma to USC, all of a sudden it was like a bump. Like, it wasn't as hard. I don't think it was as hard as for Lincoln Riley to get Caleb Williams to USC as it was for DeBoer to get Penix to come to UW.
Yeah. I mean, I think you would say that Kalen DeBoer, to a far greater degree, actually took a 4-8 team and made it 10-2. Whereas Lincoln Riley took a 4-8 team, blew it up, completely rebuilt the roster, and turned them into a playoff team. And, like, look, it's college football in 2022. I think there's a lot of merit to that. You know, I don't think it's a case of like, well, but it's a different team. Well, because he's Lincoln Riley, he was able to attract all of these really talented players, and also because he's at USC. Yes, but if you're USC, that's why you swing for the fences and go get a Lincoln Riley, right? He can bring Caleb Williams. He can bring Mario Williams. You know, pull Travis Dye from the portal. Is it Austin Jones, the former Stanford running back? Speaking of Stanford guys transferring out from the portal, Jordan Addison from the portal. So, USC's a last second 2-point conversion in Utah away from being undefeated.
Yep.
A year after going 4-8. So, like, I would have and again, we will see. We will see how petty the conference head coaches are.
I hope they're super petty.
I think Penix had a good enough season that you can justify, like, giving him a vote without feeling like totally outrageous about it.
Yeah.
Even though I would vote for Caleb Williams, and Kalen DeBoer and Jonathan Smith both did a good enough job as head coaches this year that you could cast your vote for them over Lincoln Riley. Even though I would probably vote for Lincoln Riley, without it looking like you're just doing it to slight Lincoln Riley.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We're not going to find out how the voting breaks down. You just know who the winner was, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some coaches who, kind of look more at Washington and think, well, you know, they're not bailing on the conference, first of all, yet. And, you know, maybe he did it a little bit more with, you know, actually taking the roster he was giving and flipping it from 4-8 to 10-2, although Michael Penix Jr. won one very big asterisk to that conversation. So it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out. You enjoy your Thanksgiving?
I did. It was awesome. We had 55 at Thanksgiving. 55. My aunt, Cecilia, made four turkeys. She cooked four turkeys.
Where are you at on turkey?
I like turkey. T- It tastes like the holiday. I like, it's always been more about the people than the food for me. Turkey's fine. Turkey's absolutely fine.
I'm so down on turkey.
Really? Why? Yeah.
It's not that I haven't had good turkey. And you know what? I like deli meat turkey.
Yeah.
But just the bird, I don't get excited when the big turkey comes out of the oven and it's carved up. It just looks dry to me.
But you get some gravy, you get some stuffing, then you get sandwiches the next day.
Yeah, but like if you need to supplement it with all this other stuff for it to be like tolerable. I think it's the worst of the holiday meats, and it would never be my preference to prepare a turkey. I'll eat it. I've had good turkey, but I'd always rather have a prime rib or brisket or ham.
I think it's the best of the holiday meats because of its versatility and how long it lasts. Like that can be a full two and a half days of sustenance. And while on its own, I would tend to agree with you. It is the least tasty of all the holiday meats. You're not looking at it in a vacuum. Like turkey's coming with a squad. Like turkey has some armaments. There's some mashed potatoes that you can use to make mashed potato pancakes if you'd like and eat that with the turkey. There's some gravy. There's some stuffing. There's some cranberry. There's some green bean salad. Like there is a lot that's coming to the table with turkey. So don't just pretend it's just turkey. It's not a one-man show. It's a team.
Yeah, I guess that's my issue. I need a, you know, I need a captain at the center of that table. I need someone who can go score the basketball, you know? And I need a great thrower of the football.
See,
who can win you football games?
Turkey is the kind of point guard of a quarterback that Pete Carroll loves. Like it sets up other plays. It's a great distributor of the opportunities.
Turkey wears the wristband.
Oh boy! Did you see Russ got yelled at by a rank and file dude? Like that.
It's just something. It's just something every week at this point.
That guy has 3.5 sacks in a 7-year career, and he's screaming at Russell Wilson on the sideline, and the head coach who's directly in front of him just doesn't even bat an eye, like just doesn't even react to it. It's like oh.
Yeah. Russell Wilson played in a Rose Bowl.
He sure did. Almost won that Rose Bowl.
Yeah. Enjoy the game Friday, everybody.
Go Troy.
I think Kalen DeBoer gave Washington fans permission to root for USC. Did you see that? He was asked.
Yeah. I agree with that.
You're rooting for USC, and he was like, yeah, we've had to be pretty selfish these last couple weeks with who you're cheering for. But he said, hey, the way I look at it is we already did Utah a favor.
Heck yeah.
So enjoy the game, and we'll talk to you next week.